Hello, a very warm welcome to you. It's great to have you back with us. As you know, we are now at chapter 18 of the Bhagavad Gita, and Sister Denise and I are going through practically every single shloka of chapter 18 so that we are able to look at what the text says and its meaning and convey that meaning to you. Sister Denise, it's great to have you back with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Sister Denise, at the end of the last episode, we stopped at, I believe it's verse 35. So we are now on verse 36, and I understand that God is saying to Arjuna, let me show you how and what happiness is. And the text reads, "Now hear from me, Arjuna, the threefold happiness that one enjoys through practice and in which one comes to the end of suffering." So a twofold message contained in the stanza, how to create happiness and how to end suffering. Verse 37 reads, "That which in the beginning is like poison, but in the end like nectar, that happiness born from the tranquility of one's own mind is declared to be sattvic." So, Sister Denise, I didn't realize that sattvic had anything to do with even past sorrow. I thought it was happiness from the beginning. But this stanza says otherwise to me. How do you interpret it?
It's defining sattvic, and it's compared with rajasic, which is really the opposite. So, happiness is generally considered what you experience through the senses. I think what it's saying is that what is good doesn't necessarily feel good. And so it's being described as it starts off as poison and ends up as nectar. But I don't think it means that sattvic itself starts off as poison and then turns into nectar. But it's saying that the kind of happiness which is sattvic isn't pleasant in the initial stages as a sense impression, but it's good for you. For example, medicine that's really healing for you may be bitter to the taste, but it's really good for you. Whereas there may be something that tastes really nice to the tongue, but it's actually bad for you.
We tend to focus on things that we like, and we want more of what feels good, either emotionally or even physically. What you're saying is there's a level of deception in there, isn't it?
Well, exactly. And this is why it said that the senses themselves and sense perception is fundamentally deceptive. What you have to do is use your discrimination to recognize that what feels good isn't necessarily good, and what feels bad isn't necessarily bad. So it's a difference between what it feels like and what it is. The whole advertising industry is based on this principle that people go for what feels good. And so in advertising, you make something look good, and then people go for it. We have this expression, don't judge a book by its cover. But the book publishing industry knows that everybody does judge a book by the cover, so they make beautiful covers, whether the contents are good or not. People tend to be anyway rajasic or tamasic. The teachings of the Gita are asking us to develop our power of discernment and discrimination to such a point that we do not get deceived by what is, you know, seeming or tasting or being unpleasant, because what something is not the same as what it feels like.
That's mind-blowing, Sister Denise. It's extremely simple to understand, but the vast majority of the viewers listening to you right now, watching you right now, do not know this to be a fact because it's not taught, it's not understood, and even if one becomes aware of it, it's easier to ignore it because that which is real doesn't actually advertise itself, that which is true and real, whereas that which is fake is presented to you in your face.
Well, because of us being so caught up mentally with the sense organs and the objects of sense perception, which is where the Gita began. Here we are at the end, still with the same problem, but of course we've got very fine detail about the three different kinds of happiness. So I think it's very, very good education for us.
I want to now move on to the next shloka, which reads, that which in the beginning through contact between the senses and their objects is like nectar, and in the end like poison, that happiness is declared to be rajasic. What is of interest here to me, Sister Denise, is that it is understood that there's still happiness to be gained, irrespective of the presence of poison. So even that which is poisonous in reality can still make somebody happy. That is a contradiction, a total contradiction. It presents itself as a contradiction, but it's so weird to think that that which is poison can make you happy.
Well, let's take a look at some examples of poisonous things that make you happy. Take heroin, for example. That's a first-class example. You take a bit of heroin, it makes you feel so blissful and beautiful that the whole world becomes heaven, but it takes you to hell. You know, it's very, very deceptive. If it weren't so deceptive, people would never become addicted. Take a very beautiful person with whom you have a heavy karmic account. That beautiful person, their skin, their smell, everything, you get caught up in a beautiful, amorous relationship, and lots of happiness for the first little while. But because of the karmic account, it turns around and becomes hell. You suffer a lot. But it seems very good at the time. How often do we use this expression? It seemed like a good idea at the time.
Then there's the morning after to deal with.
By comparing what's been spoken in the Gita with our experience in the 21st century world, especially the Western world, we see that most people are operating in very much of a rajasic way, which means that you are going to be deceived by how you perceive the world to be. And if you act on your perceptions rather than on your discrimination power, you will be deceived.
It gets worse. Yeah. Verse 39 reads, that happiness which both in the beginning and afterwards deludes the self, arising from sleep, indolence, and negligence, is declared to be tamasic. The description of the negative qualities that takes one down this karmically thorn-ridden path is very clearly enunciated in the last part of verse 39. You said earlier, Sister Denise, that a lot of people fall under the rajasic category. I think there's scarcely a few on the planet that do not fall under the tamasic category. And I think it's a question of, we don't know that we don't know.
Well, right, that's right. People don't really think about being that bad. If something is bad, you look for justifications and different ways of putting it, or you say, well, it really isn't that bad, or something like this. It's quite difficult, I think, for a tamasic person who is in this state, sleepy, indolent, negligent, you know, not caring. There's a lot of people who don't care about themselves, who don't care about each other, and then who do actions that arise from that. And they live a very meaningless and often quite unpleasant life. So we can maybe hardly call it happiness, but it is the third kind of happiness.
Let's go to verse 40. There is no being either on earth or yet in heaven among the gods who can exist free from these three qualities born of material nature.
This is a very interesting shloka because one of the things that we find in the 18th chapter is that it's not sending everybody to nirvana, it is sending people towards heaven. I think about it particularly in terms of the studies that we do in the Brahma Kumaris, where we look at the concept of jivan mukti, liberation in life, where we look at the idea of going from the Kali Yuga, the Iron Age, the world of hell, to the Satyuga, the world of heaven, a world where all the people are like gods and goddesses. So in this verse, it is showing that on this earth, in the material world, even the deities, the gods and goddesses, are involved in the three gunas, and of course they would be involved in sattva, the pure stage, and then as you go through the cycle, of course you reincarnate and then you finally arrive at the tamopradhan guna.
I'd like to take you now to verse 41, which reads, "The duties of the Brahmins, the Kshatriyas, the Vaishyas, and of the Shudras, Arjuna, are distributed according to the qualities which arise from their own nature."
Yeah, and this continues on from what I was saying in regard to verse 40, because it says in the Raj Yoga that we practice in Brahma Kumaris that you are a Brahmin when you are practicing soul consciousness, God consciousness, all the different disciplines of purity, in the period of time that we call Purushottam Sangam Yuga, the confluence age, that is superimposed at the end of the Kali Yuga and the beginning of the Satyuga. So that's the stage of the Brahmin, who is called the twice born, the one who is the child of Brahma. And then the Kshatriya refers to deities are not assigned duty. And of course, deities don't have any duties. Deities operate automatically. It's like a predestined choreography that the deity performs without thinking, without having to decide what's right and wrong and so on, because it's the Satopradhan state of the world. The Kshatriya is the ruler, the warrior, and in terms of the person who's in spiritual effort, the person who has to battle between right and wrong, between what they know better and what they feel inclined to do. The prakruti of a Kshatriya would be not Satopradhan. It would be moving towards the Rajasic. And then the Vaishya is very much Rajasic. And the Shudra would be Tamasic. And so this state of the human soul, as it passes through all the reincarnations, through the cycle, the condition of the soul is getting more and more materialistic, materially minded, and more under the influence of matter, and less pure, less and less powerful.
Sister Denise, I now would like to take you to verse 46, which reads, "By worshipping with his own proper duty, him from whom all beings have their origin, him by whom all this universe is pervaded, man finds perfection." Sister Denise, how does one worship within his own duty? How is duty linked to one's relationship with God? There are many who are ambivalent or totally ignorant as to what their duty is, irrespective of the description that we've been just provided with in the previous three shlokas.
Well, if we look for a moment, you see 42 talks about very pure qualities, tranquility, restraint, austerity, purity, forgiveness, uprightness, knowledge, wisdom. This is the characteristic of the Brahmin. So your duty, you see, we use the word dharma, which is translated as duty. So if you say the dharma also means the way you are, your nature. So if you're a Brahmin by nature, then you would have these qualities. There is a difference between a Brahmin by nature and a Brahmin caste born. You see, they may not have that nature. But here, I think we're definitely talking about the nature of a person, where your nature is very pure, then you're a Brahmin, and you have these qualities. And then you move to verse 43, the nature of a Kshatriya, there into heroism, majesty, firmness, skill, not fleeing in battle, generosity and lordly spirit, you see. So that's the sign of a warrior type of person. And you can even look at these as different personality types. The Vaishya, this is the business person, the trader. So plowing, cow herding, trade, you see, that is their nature, that is their sanskaras, you see. So looking at this as different personality types, how society is made up of different types of people, and then they work together in harmony. If you stick with what you are and who you are, you're doing as you should.
Yes, Denise, as I hear you discuss these shlokas, specifically the duty and the personality profiling that is contained from 42, 43, 44, etc., I'm wondering how these shlokas are relevant to the 21st century. IT technician is not mentioned in this, surgeon is not mentioned in this, irrespective of the fact that their profession that exists now that did not and could not have existed at the time the Gita was written. How do we apply what is said here to current day living?
I think in a sense all the professions would come under Vaishya, which is the business people. Because if you're in any of the professions, you are trying to make more money than you would if you would be, say, a blue-collar worker. You are a white-collar worker, and you can get quite wealthy, but it's all about business. You're not a warrior, you're not a Brahmin, the priest caste, you're not a deity, you're a business person. So I think that it's actually interesting to see that personality profiling has been going on since very, very ancient times. And in the 21st century, you have this personality profiling, and then you also have the idea that everybody's equal. But of course, equal theoretically, but in practically, it's we're all very, very different. We do fall in different categories. And I think the Gita, plus the aim of many people, they want to find themselves. Who am I? What am I? If you look at 46, where it talks about worshipping with his own proper duty, this makes us think of the concept that work is worship. You know, there are people who subscribe to that idea.
Sister Denise, could you take us through your understanding then of verse 46?
Well, I think in verse 46, we're going back to the Vedic concepts of the omnipresence of God and the idea that God split himself up in two fragments, and some of them are one category, some of them are another category, and if you are operating according to your category, that makes the whole thing perfect. And that is a Vedic idea.
I'd like to ask you to take us through verse 47, because as one reads it at face value, it's not very easy to understand, because the first question that one has to answer is what is one's duty, and if you cannot answer that, then you can't actually answer 47. Better one's own duty, though imperfect, than the duty of another well performed. Performing the duty prescribed by one's own nature, one does not incur evil. What if one wants to improve one's lot in life and go higher, climb up the corporate ladder and do a better duty than what yours is? How does evil fit into this picture? And Sister Denise, these verses, do they refer to someone's profession, or is it a vocation, a calling, like to take on the cloth? Or is it relates to the service one does to humanity? What is the shloka talking about?
Again, we're going back to the Vedic traditions, and the idea is that whatever caste you're born into, it is incorrect to even think about shifting to another caste. And this is why it's also a belief that you should marry within your own caste. And so I think that the people who were creating the social systems in the ancient times, they wanted everything to be stable. So let the warriors carry on being warriors, let the Brahmins be Brahmins, let the traders be traders, so that the order of society remains in this very fixed four categories or four levels, and that anybody who tries to shift up or down, of course people want to go up, they're going to destabilize the system. And what you also have is signs of the end of the cycle, or signs of the end of the Kali Yuga, is people moving out of their prescribed caste. And one of the things that you find in India at the moment is there are people from India scattered all over the world. There's an enormous amount of intermarriage with different races, different cultures, within the different castes in India. So the whole system that was set up maybe a couple of thousand years ago is completely fallen apart, or, you know, getting that way. And so these are known as signs of the end of the world. So I think that this was always known. And so to have a shloka like this saying, you will not incur evil if you stay where you are, because there is this belief that if you try shifting, it means that that's a bad sign, it's inauspicious, it's a sign of things falling apart. And of course, this is what you have at this time, which is another reason why we would say that the time period where the knowledge of the Gita is given is at this cusp period, the end of the Kali Yuga, that takes you to the beginning of the next cycle in its Satyuga stage. So this is very interesting in that respect.
Does this particular part of the Bhagavad Gita hold any value for somebody who was born in the West and who only heard of the caste system? There is somebody in the West who has an interest in the Gita because it has so much to offer, okay? But this caste aspect, the caste duty and caste aspect, has only any relevance for you if you're if you have this type of mindset. Caste is unknown. If you take birth outside India, if you took birth into any of the other religions, that has nothing to do with Hinduism whatsoever. If you have no experience of Indian culture, then how do you apply this, and how does it make sense to you? It doesn't.
Well, not necessarily. First of all, outside of India, though you don't have a caste system, you do have a class system.
And what bugs me about this is that self-improvement is part and parcel of human nature. Okay, you find yourself born into a set of circumstances that you hate, and you want to improve yourself. Is this scripture authority for the fact that don't bother, you're doomed?
This belongs to the tradition. You might want to make reference to the Manu Smriti, which is very much saying, stay where you are, don't move, you know. But of course, if we are looking at the entire Gita from the angle of a liberal-minded, intellectual, educated Western person, you are going to take the bits that speak to you and disregard the bits that don't. And I think that if this doesn't speak to you, leave it.
Okay, leave it. Yeah, I prefer to leave this. 49, we come back to the intellect. With his intellect unattached at all times, with conquered self, Free from desire, by renunciation, one attains the supreme state of freedom from action. Two aspects grab my attention there. Intellect unattached and conquered self.
You know, there's this idea of self-mastery. I think a person who has mastered applying their mind, their intellect, their sanskaras, the different aspects of their consciousness, this is how we would need to interpret conquered self, rather than that you have subdued yourself, but you have become a master using the different attributes of your consciousness.
Sister Denise, thank you so much for what you've shared. I think this brings us to the end of this episode, and we will see you in the next episode for further discussion on chapter 18. Thank you. So there you go. There are aspects in this part of the Bhagavad Gita that may not make sense to you, and aspects which may sit very deeply with you. Sister Denise has invited you to take on that which you do accept and put it into practice, and discard that which doesn't resonate with you. So I hope that message is something that you can use in your practical life. Thank you so much for joining us, and goodbye.